You're listening to another top-rated show on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome to the American Hour with your host, Commander Tom Garcia, on the USA Talk Radio Network.
Welcome, man. I am Tom Garcia. This is the American Hour, and we've got a good guest lined up today. We've got a good show lined up today, and we're going to be talking about conservatism. We're also going to be talking about some stuff in the headlines, and of course, my lovely co-host, Paula Lausanne-Ostman, is with me here today. How are you doing today, Paula?
I'm doing great. How are you?
Good. Well, we're starting this a little bit early today because I've got to leave early. I'll explain it to everybody, and maybe I shouldn't take the time to do it, but I'm in Rio de Janeiro. We're broadcasting live from Rio, and, of course, Paula is in Boston. She's not here in Rio. Do you wish you were here in Rio, Paula?
Kind of. I saw some pictures on the Today Show this morning that makes me want to go.
It's not bad. And the weather's been pretty nice.
Good.
It's, you know, got some a lot of beachfront property and everything like that. I didn't go out for a walk today. Usually I'd go out and go for a little bit of a walk, but I've been working on too much stuff. So, yeah, honestly, I come here all the time. I'd rather be in Boston today. But anyway, that's another story. So I have got, because the ride is so long on this particular flight to get from the hotel to the airport, I've got to leave extra early. Now, I'm not doing this the rest of the month. The rest of the month, I'm flying to Sao Paulo, Brazil. It's a later flight, so this doesn't impact it. So, but we're starting a little bit early. Our guest is still going to come on at 4 o'clock, Mark Ross, and talk a little bit more about him coming up. But Paula has been joining me as a guest host, and she's going to continue to guest host with me. And you all are familiar with my background and know that I'm a constitutionalist when I campaign for Congress. My platform was the Constitution, so I'm a conservative. And you know what? Mark Ross today is going to help us figure out the different types of conservatives and how conservatives can actually unite. And that's really the thrust of his story entitled, What Exactly is a Conservative? And he's going to talk to us about that today. But Paula, for the edification of our listeners, describe yourself in political terms and how you think you would view yourself.
I feel that I would view myself as an all-around American who believes in what this country was founded upon, when it was founded. And I don't lean too much to the left, and I don't lean too much to the right. I do look at three sides of the coin. And I'd like to hear what everybody has to say. I go out and vote. I go out and vote for who, you know, I think is going to do the best job possible for the country.
Well, good. That sounds like, to me, a conservative. But you know what? People don't like labels, and the only reason I do that is I think it does help define. I am pretty conservative, but there are a few things that I'm a little bit liberal on. So everybody's a little bit different, and I think the key is that people search and research to help them decide what they want to be. What's helped me is digging into history. I love the Constitution, and I always wanted to know more about it, so I began reading not only about the Constitution but our founders and what they had to say, and that helped me because I think they created a wonderful document if we would stick to it, and that was the reason I got into politics. I felt like we weren't sticking to this roadmap that is a very successful one, and if we can get back to it, that we will be successful as a country again. So in any case, that's kind of where we stand. But let's talk about one thing, one follow-up thing from yesterday. And we talked about the People's Budget and the put together by the progressive liberal Democrats in Congress. And the more I got to looking at that last night, Paula, I really came to a conclusion what that whole bill is about. If you really dig through it and read through it, and we went through specifics, this is going to be an overall generalization. Can you – hold on just a second. You know what that is? You hear that phone ringing in the background?
Who?
I don't know. Can you hear that, Paula?
I can hear it. Are they looking for you? It's time to leave?
Yeah. You know what it is? Every time when you're on a layover, you get a wake-up call. And I'm going to they won't call back for about 5 minutes. I'm going to go disconnect the phone here in a few minutes. But in any case, the summary of that whole thing, this is what it really boils down to. They're going to tax us more to pay for the bigger government they want. Everything they're going to spend, it's all an expansion of government. It's all there. They don't hide it at all. It's an expansion of government. Everything that they're going to tax us for, the increases in taxes are going to be to grow government. Not 1 cent is going to be used to pay down debt. When they say they reduce deficit, what they're really saying is they're reducing the amount of money they would have to borrow to grow government because they're going to do it one way or another. So instead of doing it like we've been doing it for the last several years by just printing money and borrowing money, they're going to just tax us more. But they have no intention whatsoever. And as I said yesterday, they're like crack addicts. They cannot stop growing government. They cannot stop spending our money. And so what the progressives in Congress have said, we're going to take more of it, and we're going to keep growing the size of government because we think that's best for you. Doesn't pay down the debt whatsoever. Now, when they, like I said, when they talk about reducing the deficit, what they're saying is simply this. We're not going to have to borrow as much because we're going to take more of your money, and that's going to save us money. Well, it's not saving anybody any money. It's taking our money. And then they are going to reduce defense spending by bringing soldiers back from Iraq and Afghanistan. And I don't have a problem with reducing defense spending, but that's the only real spending in government they're going to reduce. They're going to grow everything else. So that's the bottom line with that people's budget that they put out a couple days ago. All right, I'm going to let you talk about what you think about it. I'm going to go get rid of that phone. All right.
All right. Well, the New York Times just put out a report that the House passed a compromise budget bill to finance the federal government through the end of the fiscal year in September, and the vote brought one budget clash to a close. Each of the two parties prepared for one another. The vote was 260 to 167, with 59 Republicans breaking ranks with their party leadership to vote against the deal, which called for $38 billion in spending cuts this year. So that just happened. And
that's what you're talking about today?
Today, just now. It just came in over the wire that they just passed.
Oh, okay, I'm back. Tell me what that vote count was again.
The vote count was 260 to 167. With 59 Republicans breaking ranks with their party leadership to vote.
Yeah. Okay. Well, you know, I've been saying it, and I think we've been seeing it. I think I brought it up yesterday, and you brought it up as well, that more and more Republicans are probably going to start defecting, because as the news came out yesterday, and Rush Limbaugh, I have to give him credit, a few days ago was talking about it. He didn't have all the details. But now the CBO has crunched the numbers and said that the 39 or 38 point whatever billion it is that they were talking about in cuts for the agreement they came up with, not the continuing resolution to just keep us going here a week, but the agreement that would take us to the end of the year with $39 billion in cuts really only adds up to about $230, $250 million. What a joke. And here's one of the things that I found today that sort of bothered me. It was one of our House member conservative aides, so it's one of our Republican conservative elected representatives, and an aide to this Republican. And they don't say things unless they're allowed to say things. But here's what this aide said.
The
aide said, we knew not all of the $39 billion would be real cuts. So our representatives, when they voted for this, and it wasn't in the news yet, knew ahead of time that there were fake cuts in there, that misleading cuts, and none of our representatives said anything about it. None of them called out their own party. This is why I ran for Congress, because I wouldn't have taken this stuff. I would have said, this is a bunch of baloney, and I would have been all over the news talking about this, because this is about America. It's not about a party. I've been a Republican my whole life, but I'm tired of the shenanigans that have been going on in Washington. And so I find this very, very disappointing. But here's what the continued thing he says is, we knew not all of the $39 billion would be real cuts, but to find out that almost none of it is real is very disappointing. I'm disappointed that you would even know that some of it is not real, and you wouldn't have brought this forward and let me know as a constituent, the person that you represent. So, and I'm talking in general terms there, but anyway, so I found that today, and I see there was another article that I looked at that talked about there may be more defections from the Republican Party after this news had come out, and this thing may not. I think we talked about that yesterday, didn't we, that it may not pass. I had a feeling it would, but I still think it will. I just don't think they will have enough defections for it not to pass. But now the Senate leadership is talking about filibustering it so that it can't pass in the Senate because they're ticked off. What do you think about that?
Well, they're saying right now that, you know, it's going to go to the Senate, and it's expected to pass quickly and to be sent to the president's desk.
Yeah, okay. Well, you know, there we have it. And so I think a lot of Republicans, as I said yesterday, are looking for the bigger fight, or what they consider to be the bigger fight, and that is next year, next fiscal year's budget. Yeah, that's going to be a big fight, and I don't know if they stick to their guns for just once, then the same thing's going to happen. You know, why stonewall an entire year's budget when they could have done it with just the remainder of this budget? And a lot of articles today were saying the reason they've had a hard time cutting the $100 billion that they wanted and can't really even cut the $39 billion that they said they had to come up with fluff is because most of the year's over and most everything's paid for. Now, I did see a quote, somebody saying that, well, you know, it's one thing to cut appropriations. It's another thing to cut or to take back what's already been paid for. Not true. Not true. Right. You can take things back. And they're just not willing to cross that line and be a little more aggressive about it. So I find it all very disappointing. So anyway, another interesting article that I saw today was in the Wall Street Journal. And I didn't write down the author of this. I apologize. But the title is Obama's Speech is Dishonest. And under the Obama tax plan, the Bush rates would be repealed for the top brackets. Yet the cost of extending all Bush rates in 2011 over 10 years was about $3.7 trillion. $3 trillion of that was for everything but the top brackets. So that's you, me, everybody else except the top two brackets. The $3 trillion is the average American, middle-class American. But Obama says he's going to extend the cuts for middle-class America. So where's he going to, you know, get all his money from? According to IRS data, the entire tax table income of everyone earning over $100,000 in 2008 was about $1.58 trillion. Wow. So he's going to cut and spend, but spend a lot, like he's already been spending, when if every American that makes over $100,000, every single one, all the way up to the billionaires, were taxed at 100% of their earnings, it wouldn't cover his deficit for just this year. So for him to stand up and talk about raising rates on the top income brackets, top two brackets, and that's going to solve our problems, and he did talk about other things, it doesn't even come close. I mean, not even close does it come. So that was the reason the article was called Obama's Speech Dishonest. And I know that I'll get to that. Well, Charles Krauthammer called it a disgrace. Did you see that article?
I did. I did see that.
Okay.
He had really.
Yeah.
He had,
and it's. He had what, really, what did you take out of that speech?
Well, I mean, he just said that he had really heard a speech by a president so shallow, so hyper-partisan, and so intellectually dishonest. Outside the last couple of weeks of a presidential election where you are allowed to call your opponent anything short of a traitor. But we're a year and a half away from the election day, and it was supposed to be a speech about policy. So.
Yeah. Yeah,
so
that's exactly it. I know Krauthammer gives, I don't just want to say he gives Obama a pass, but he looks to find, you know, where he's saying not necessarily the right thing, but what will work for him. Whether he likes it or not, Charles Krauthammer seems to be a pretty straightforward guy, and for him to call it a disgrace, I think is a pretty damning commentary on that speech, and I would agree with it, quite honestly. Now, you know that we had Kelly Townsend on the show on the 12th, and she was talking about the bill that Arizona was trying to pass to ensure that all candidates running for office must be eligible for that office and must prove it one way or another. So I did a little digging today, and I know for a fact, running as a congressional candidate, a U.S. congressional candidate, that you have to provide certain information to the state in order to get on the ballot. Now, you don't have to provide a birth certificate proving your age, and I didn't even have to provide a driver's license, but because I live in the state of Florida, they can look me up and see who I am and know that I'm the right age. But I did have to sign a loyalty oath saying that I am who I say I am and I am qualified. So if the state gets to make those laws, some people think, well, no, this is a federal election, so it's up to the federal government. The federal government only oversees the campaign contributions, the finance aspect of it. That's the only thing I know, because I had to deal with those reports for a year and a half, 2 years. The Federal Elections Commission deals with finance reporting. That's it. It's the state that determines eligibility to make it on their ballot, because the state of Florida, the state of Texas, the state of Arizona, that ballot is their ballot. It may be for a federal election, and they ensure that electors and the process conforms to the Constitution, but the Constitution doesn't lay out how the state runs its elections. So one of the people in that article, of course, Democrats, said, oh, this will never make it through the courts. Well, it'll never go to the Supreme Court. It'll never go to a federal court, because it's not federal jurisdiction. It's the state's jurisdiction. And the state election committee gets to determine the process by which. So I think it's going to stand. Unless they've got some really liberal state judges, I believe it's going to stand, and we'll have other states follow suit and require for a presidential election. And again, they can require whatever they want. They could require just a, again, an oath, a signature from the president saying, yes, I am who I say I am, and I am the age I am, and I was born here, and, you know, all the different conditions. You know, I looked at the state of Florida's requirements for the presidential election, and they require the party to vet and provide the names of the nominee or the candidates for the primary election. So they kind of leave it up to the party, the Republican Party or the Democrat Party or other parties, and don't really require a loyalty oath or other things like that. But that's because that's how Florida set it up. It's Florida's jurisdiction, and they can set it up the way they want to. So I think we're going to see some issues come along with this. I don't know how it's going to resolve itself, but and this was just the Senate in Arizona that passed it. It's still got to go to the House of Representatives, but they do have a Republican House, and so it's probably going to – and, of course, Jan Brewer is the governor there, so it's going to pass. It's going to become law, and we'll see what the fallout is from that. But I'm tired of these judges making rulings based on no actual enumeration or lack of enumeration in the state constitution or even the federal constitution. So I'm going to be watching this one closely. So that's what's going on in Arizona. And we did have Kelly Townsend on. She's the leader of the and founder, co-founder of the Greater Phoenix Tea Party Patriots, a pretty large group of people there in Phoenix that are part of that group. And you can go back to our archives if you go to usatalkradionetwork.com. And click on my page. There'll be a link there to take you to the archives, and you can see any of the shows that we've done up to this point. And that was a pretty good show with Kelly on Tuesday. So let's see, what else? Tell people how can they find us on Facebook? Well, go to the American Hour Radio Show page on Facebook, and you'll find information about upcoming shows and past shows. And also on Twitter, you can follow me at the American Hour. And if somebody wants to follow you on Twitter, how can they do that, Paula? Uh-oh. We didn't lose Paula, did we? Oh, we did. She had to call back. Paula, you still there? Sorry. Did you drop off and have to call back?
No, I'm still here.
Oh, somehow you got clicked off. But in any case, I was asking you, and if for some reason the microphone got turned off on you, if somebody wants to get a hold of you or follow you on Twitter, how do they do that?
They are going to type in at Megawatt Queen. They're going to spell out Megawatt Queen, and Megawatt Queen is capital MWQ, and that's where they're going to find me.
Okay. That sounds good. All right. Do me a favor. We've got one caller. This might be Mark Ross calling in. Can you go
it
screen
is.
Him? And I'll it is Mark?
It is him.
Oh, you already screened. Okay, well, then you did that. Okay, great. All right, well, let's see. It's just about top of the hour. If he's ready to go, we'll get him on. That's a couple minutes early. That'll help me get out of here. And as I was explaining before, and I don't know if I went the whole thing, but I'm pretty much packed up and ready to go. When we conclude the show today, I basically run down to the lobby, check out, and get on a bus and fly back, unfortunately. So we don't get to do this the regular time of 5 o'clock Eastern, but that won't be a problem the rest of the month, and I'll make sure pay better attention to my schedule in the future. But let's before I bring Mark Ross on, I came across Mark. I'm going to bring him on, but I came across Mark on Twitter because I saw some really interesting tweets coming out from him and information, and I started following him. And the more I looked at what he was doing, I said, this guy's sharp, and he knows what he's talking about, especially when it comes to the Constitution and our founders. I really like that, and that's the kind of thing that I really get into. So I started corresponding a little with him or commenting on some of his comments, and from that we got to know each other a little bit, and he is the owner and manager and runs and writes for Hyperblog Cafe. You can go to hyperblogcafe.com to see his writings, and there's some great articles on there. But one that really caught my eye and made me decide that I've got to get this guy on the show here soon is an article he wrote entitled, What Exactly is a Conservative? And so we're going to bring you on now. Mark, tell us a little bit more about yourself and where people and how people can reach you if you want them to or they need to.
Hey, Tom, how are you?
Pleased to have you on, Mark. How was your day today?
Thank you. Thank you for having me.
Oh, yeah, it's a pleasure. It's a pleasure.
Pretty good. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. So besides Hyperblog Cafe, is there anything else that you're working on or doing right now that would be of interest to people to go take a look at?
In the political realm, not really besides that. I mean, you know, just been writing on there for, obviously I've been following, if you'd like just a quick history, I'm actually from Philadelphia, Pennsylvania, and originally, and at a very young age, around 16, I started working in Old City, Philadelphia, and it was there it started taking roots, you know, our love for our founders, you know, Independence Hall and everything else, and so I used to frequent Independence Hall a lot, but it was in 2008, so my love for the founders and the founding of our country was started very early, but it was, you know, like a lot of people, I'd follow the news, tangentially follow the news, and it was in 2008 where, you know, the House of Cards kind of came down and the Tea Party movement started, you know, that I got thrusted into writing, you know, on the Internet.
Yeah.
And it basically brings me to where we are today, you know.
Excellent, excellent. Now, if somebody wants to follow you on Twitter, what do they need to look for on Twitter?
Oh, it's MarkRoss67, MarkRoss67.
Okay, MarkRoss67, MarkRoss67. Yeah.
Facebook
and on Facebook,
well,
what do they look for there?
Same thing,
MarkRoss?
MarkRoss67. Mm-hmm.
67. Okay, great. And, you know, I'm trying to remember, do you use Facebook for political commentary as well as Twitter? Because I know that's where I see a lot
of
your stuff
is
on Twitter.
That's all I use it for. Yeah, just
okay, good.
Same concept as Twitter, Tom. Mm-hmm.
Excellent. Well, I encourage people to follow you on Twitter because I do. You're on my top priority list, and I always like seeing your stuff. And do you put stuff out on Twitter every day?
Oh, yeah. Generally, I do definitely tweet every day. Yeah, you know, obviously, like everybody else, I have other priorities in life I have to take care of, but I like to come on and tweet every day for sure. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, okay. Well, listen, I let in a little bit, and I've talked about you on past shows and that you were coming up and what we were going to discuss, and we've got a couple things we can discuss besides your one particular article that I really like. But tell us about this article, What Exactly is a Conservative? Why did you write that, and you know, what was the basis, the purpose for writing that? I mean, I kind of know what the purpose is, but you explain it to everybody and how you arrived at deciding to write that.
Well, sure. I if I just may just step back briefly, that the approach I started taking with the blog site when I first started, I'm not really a hyper-partisan, and I think most people would surmise that from looking at my tweets. I'm actually a registered independent, so I'm not a hyper-partisan. I generally try to take the philosophical, you know, approach, and most of my blog sites based around that, the Constitution, philosophy, you know, libertarian-leaning insights, founding principles, etc. That being said, Tom, you know, I think one of the big symptoms of our country, and I would include myself in this, I was an ex-Democrat, I was a Democrat for years, is a lot of us believe in our founders, or we say we do, you know, we say we believe in our founders. I just believe that these parties, both Democrat and Republican Party, have, I don't know, maybe poison is a strong word. Certainly, though, neither party, as most of us realize today, follow the Constitution or enumerated powers in the Constitution. Neither party's diligent to it. Neither party even really, in my humble opinion, seems to even care that much about getting us back to that foundation. So I guess the bottom line is, you know, I just started thinking about these things. Like, what a lot of people are calling themselves a conservative, and I think everybody's heart is in the right place. I'm a conservative, meaning, generally speaking, I believe in the founders of our country. I believe in fiscal conservatism. But the more you start understanding the Constitution, the more you dive into the Constitution and what the founders' original intents were, you start seeing, like, everybody, not everybody that calls himself a conservative is exactly in alignment with perhaps what the founders would have considered constitutional, you know?
Yeah.
Basically, that is what led me to it. I'm thinking to myself, you know, I would watch people like Hannity and who, you know, I agree with on a lot of things, but there's other things that I'm like, Sean, how can you be saying these things? They're hardly constitutional yet, you know. So, you know, it's just a series of things that led me to really start, thinking about that more. And that's basically,
I know exactly what you're saying. Yeah, I know exactly what you're saying, and that's why in my congressional campaign I talked about my platform is the Constitution, and I said we've got a roadmap here for success. We've got to get back to following it.
Mm.
And that was not, as one of my good friends then said, Mark Vance, who's a great constitutionalist, and he knows a lot more about the Constitution than I probably ever will, he said, Tom, the Constitution is not left or right. It's just what it is.
So,
and I said, you know, you're absolutely right. I don't care whether it's left or right. I just want to follow it and get back to it. But I've got to tell you this, Mark.
Mm-hmm.
I run into people all the time in my job who really don't care about the Constitution. And they, even when I explain things to them, they go like, well, I really don't care. I just want the government to do what I want it to do. And I said, so then where's the rule of law? They don't care. As long as it does what they want, they don't care about the rule of law.
Unbelievable.
And hopefully they're in a minority. But I know Paula's got a question she wants to ask you. I kind of butted in there.
No, that's okay. I wanted to know if you could describe each conservative subgroup for us.
Sure. I mean, I don't claim to have the absolute, you know, answers to all these questions. I'm sure there's a lot of different opinions. These are just a few of my observations. I listed a few. I listed social and Christian conservatives. I listed conservatives, generally speaking, political conservatives. I guess you could fit in that, like the Mark Levins, the Sean Hannitys, you know, all the different commentators. Political conservatives, and millions of people, of course. Then there's constitutional conservatives. And then lastly, I listed libertarians and Tea Partiers because there's a definite common thread between those two groups that I can see. So that's the factions I focused on in this post.
Mm-hmm. All right. Now, you so you've outlined some of these different – of course, I've read your article several times. You've outlined some of these different conservative groups. Could you step through and sort of describe each one of these groups and then tell us which group, if you think there is one, which group may be more prevalent in numbers, we'll say, and which one has the most power to sway the other conservative groups, if that's possible. But step through each group and kind of describe them to us and then kind of...
If you remember, okay, well, let me start there. The social and Christian conservatives, I myself... just to get this out on the table, I'm a Christian, a devout Christian. I've been a Christian for many, many years, and so nobody thinks that I'm bashing Christianity. I'm not. I very much am a Christian, and but at the same time, you know, it doesn't take much reading through the Constitution to see that the founders, even though we all know that many of the founders were Christian men themselves. You know, the government wasn't set up to be run as a Christian government. And in fact, the founders explicitly said, "No religious test shall be given." So it's just cut and dry. Basically, I know there's a lot of people in the country that feel, well, you know, we should have Christian values be sent down from the federal government, and you know, or I don't know how they feel imposed, pushed on, pushed upon. The rest of the country, but I don't believe that was, in fact, I don't see any evidence that that was the founders' intent. We were left free by the founders, thankfully, to pursue our own religion and our own faith. So my faith to myself is between myself, my congregation, the people I meet, you know, who share that faith. So again, it just goes back to what does the Constitution says, and you know, that basically, that I would agree with anybody that we certainly should have moral people. It takes moral people to run a country prudently and according to the founding values. But I don't believe that the founders expected or even assumed that anybody would be of one faith in our government.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we know that the purpose, one of the purposes of the First Amendment was to keep the federal government out of religion, but we had states that did have laws concerning religion, and they didn't want the federal government interfering with those state laws.
That's exactly right, Tom. That's right. How can we be? The founders were so wise. They knew, even with social issues, they knew that we're a federalist system, we're a federation of states. How can anybody go to the federal government presuming to have all the answers for all 50 states, whether it be religion, social issues, or anything?
Yeah.
I don't think anybody.
So what do you think? I'm getting a little off the subject. Here, but what do you think about the 14th Amendment being used to then apply the Bill of Rights, things that never were meant to be applied to the states, now to the states, so that we can generalize the Constitution, even hear a Supreme Court judge say that you know, government shall not make any laws concerning the established religion, but that's not what the Constitution says. It says the Congress may not, but we are now applying that to the states. What do you think about that?
The 14th, obviously, as you probably know, is a double-edged sword. I mean, there is times where, and there was times in our country, sadly, that people's constitutional rights were abridged, and, you know, where, you know, and the federal government, whether they needed to or wanted to, said, you know, we have to put an amendment in that, you know, will protect all citizens from, you know, improper treatment within their states, but they took too much latitude, and as you said, now, I think the presumption is, and correct me if I'm wrong, that the Bill of Rights implicitly is implied to all the states now, right, through the 14th Amendment? Okay.
Yeah.
Right, so it depends on who you ask, right? If there was a Second Amendment question with guns, you know, most conservatives are going to say, "Hey, that's great, no problem there," right? But what's the slippery slope? Can the Supreme Court say, you know, we're going to banish all religion from the states? Then what? So it's not a good thing.
Well, the 14th Amendment didn't specify that, you know, the Bill of Rights now apply to the states, but we've inferred that, especially with judicial rulings. And we know what the purpose of the 14th Amendment was to overturn the Dred Scott ruling of an activist Supreme Court. So to then say, well, the intent then was also, I think it's just way too much of a stretch, and I don't think it should be interpreted that way, even if in some cases it works out to where most people say that's a good way to interpret it. I don't think that's correct. And so,
that's what I try to point out. I try to point out when I see things like that, that even if something like that works in your ideological favor, it really didn't work in your favor, because you understand what I'm saying, Tom?
Yeah.
You have a Supreme Court that can nationalize something, it's not a good thing, because it could be a good thing today, and tomorrow could be an absolutely tyrannical thing, right?
Right.
Yes, absolutely.
Right.
Well, let's go to the next.
We have to always keep them in check. Yeah. Keep them all in check.
Yeah. No, I absolutely agree. Yep. Mm-hmm. Well, let's go to the next group, the political conservatives, and you said a lot of talk show hosts fall into that category. I hope I don't, but I'm not big enough yet.
Remember, these are largely my own opinions. You know,
You may be right. So describe the political conservatives to us.
Well, I put political conservatives in. I can think of no better example than maybe, let's say this Libya, the war in Libya right now. And correct me if I'm wrong. Now, when I think the political conservative, well, let me back up. I admire Ronald Reagan more today than when I was younger, because when I was a little bit younger, and I came from a Democrat family and everything else. I mean, I knew at the time that Ronald Reagan was a strong president. You know, we all realized there was a certain something about Ronald Reagan, but as I got older, I really appreciated Ronald Reagan. I really do appreciate him today. But again, I hear, let's take Sean Hannity, for example. He often says, I'm a Reagan conservative, right?
Yeah.
Have you ever heard that, Tom?
Oh, yeah.
Okay. What is a Reagan conservative? That's great. It sounds like something that came into being in, 1979, 1980? I consider myself more maybe a Jeffersonian conservative. I mean, Thomas Jefferson, he wasn't at the Constitutional Convention, but was highly influential, right, on our founding. So, again, it goes to a modern, it's kind of like a modern, what am I trying to say? It's almost like rewriting our Constitution, isn't it? It's rewriting our Constitution to fit a modern-day ideology. How does that sound?
Yeah.
So,
well, and, you know, that's... That could be a good description. I think over the last couple of years, I've heard some of these talk show hosts, though, get a little more in line with the Constitution. And I'm talking even people like Rush Limbaugh. I remember when I first started campaigning, because I was then very attuned to what was going on politically, that I would hear one of these talk show hosts talk about something, and I'd go, but what about the Constitution? My wife got tired. She's like, thought I was going to throw some of the TV or whatever, but I would be like, yeah, you've got your opinion, but... And it may be based on, a Reagan conservatism or whatever you want to call it. But what does the Constitution say? Now I think we see a lot more of these commentators referring back to the Constitution to support their opinions versus just, I think so. I think they have to now because they can't ignore it like anybody else. But it took them a while to catch on. And again, I used to be just standing there yelling at the TV, why aren't you talking about these were the so-called true conservatives, the right wingers. Even a guy like Glenn Beck took forever to finally come around and realize what was going on, that it was violating the Constitution. So
But Tom, that's an interesting word you just said, and that's an interesting word I've been thinking about. The founders, I'll admit I learned this through the 5,000 year leap, that the founders looked at left and right as right political power. They didn't think in terms of parties. Parties weren't even anticipated in the Constitutional Convention. They weren't even anticipated. So they thought of political party as left or right. The further left, the more government. The further right, less government, general terms.
Yep.
So are you a right winger if your vision for government is to be still a big government, just doing different things, right? Does that make you a right-winger? No, a right-winger is more like a libertarian who believes in absolute limited government, period.
Yeah.
Right?
Exactly.
So
there's,
when you think of...
Exactly.
Yeah, go ahead. Right. It's just a matter of we want big government, but we want government intervention in this area, but not that area, It's just like flipping a coin.
Exactly.
Right?
There are
Democrats, rights, it's Republicans. Two sides of the same coin, big government coin.
There are lots of things that conservatives would like the federal government to do that the federal government doesn't have the authority. And really, so that's why I do believe in smaller government. And I believe in smaller government, federal government, so that the states have more control, because I think we as citizens have a lot more control over our part-time working state legislators. I really do believe that. And if our focus were back on the states because we had a much smaller federal government, I think we'd have a lot more control over our lives.
And getting rid of that godforsaken federal income tax, if God willing we can ever do that. I mean, that was a real – what can be more divisive than to say, okay, one state's giving the federal government tax dollars that we're going to go do X, Y, and Z with, right? And it's just very divisive, If you return those powers back to the states, that would also, I think, provide a more harmonious existence for us too,
Right. Well, moving along, the constitutional conservative was your next category. How would you describe a constitutional conservative?
Well, I think we just got into that in large detail, that I think of people as, in science, I don't know how, just even a very basic understanding of physics, the speed of light, they use that to do a lot of formulations because it's a constant. The speed of light always goes at the same exact acceleration, never changing, never bending. So a lot of formulations in physics, they use that variable, that formula. And interestingly, they denote it with a C for the speed of light. So I think a constitution like that, it's a constant, isn't it? The constitution is a constant. We're all humans and we have emotional responses, which is understandable from a human point of view. But when people have power, right? They have power law, power to wage war, power to do all these things. Sometimes emotions can be a dangerous thing. So that's where I look at the constitution. I say, wait a minute, the constitution doesn't authorize that. Why are we doing this? You know what I mean?
Yeah,
it's pretty much that. But the point in that paragraph is that the great thing about a lot of constitutional conservatives is they're not only looking for what did the founders believe with their original intent, but they tend to be nonpartisan or less partisan. They're the group that I think really best represents our country, and you know, it's just sad what these parties have done.
Yeah. Well, the final group you listed was the Libertarians and Tea Partiers. How would you describe them?
Libertarians are an interesting group. I didn't understand the libertarian philosophy until a couple years ago. Looking back, I often believe that I kind of was libertarian in my heart. I grew up in a very Democrat working class family, and neighborhood. But they were hardworking people. I can't think of one person that advocated for the welfare state. You know, very patriotic people. But you know, they were Roosevelt Democrats, and unfortunately, maybe it's a product of the public school system, believing that, you know, Franklin Roosevelt was this great president. A couple of years ago, I started reading more deeply free market principles, you know, and it really hit me. I was like, wait a minute, Franklin Roosevelt, this guy is far from, you know what I mean? Founders imagined, you know what I mean? Or the founders instituted.
Yeah.
Therefore, in short, libertarianism, the libertarians and the Tea Partiers, I think, well, it was with Richard Nixon that the libertarians got disenfranchised and went on to form their party. I think Richard Nixon put in price controls. Richard Nixon formally ended the gold standard. And the libertarians said, that's enough, we're out. Conversely, the Tea Partier came out of the financial collapse, the housing market during the George Bush administration. So there's two groups that have a lot of similarities. They both seem to be fixed on limited government, you know, maximum individual liberties, states' rights, and pushing hard to get back to our constitutional roots. So there's a natural partnership between those two, and I'm proud to be affiliated with both of those groups, for sure.
Yeah, okay. Well, I just want to remind people I'm broadcasting live from Rio de Janeiro, Brazil. Hope the sound quality is good enough for you, but I think it'll work. And we've got a great guest today, Mark Ross, and of course I'm assisted by my co-host Paula Lozon-Ostman, and this is the American Hour on USATalkRadioNetwork.com. If you want to find out more about Mark Ross, go to hyperblogcafe.com, and it's MarkRoss67 on Twitter, MarkRoss67 on Facebook. All right, Paul, I know you're dying to ask another question.
I am. Mark, you've mentioned that the 10th Amendment as being the uniter of conservatism. Can you tell us how that would work?
The common denominator, right? That's what I said. It's the common denominator.
Peter, I apologize.
No, that's fine. It's the same idea. It's a common thread, the common factor.
Yeah.
I mean, it doesn't take much understanding of our Constitution to see that. Me and Tom already got into the federalism, states' rights. The states were never intended to be, you know, cookie cutters. The founders knew this. You know, we can't take one state or one set of principles and apply it across every state. Therefore, I guess it just stands to reason. Instead of trying to fight these battles up on the national government, you know, trying to fight each other and, you know, basically having a divided nation, it just seems that, you know, if we just took the social issues, we took all these But if we took all these side issues, I guess I'm trying to say, like social issues and everything else, and put them back into a proper place at the state level where they first belonged and should belong, then all these different conservative factions, we could all do what we have been doing wonderfully over the last 2 years, which is focusing on economics. Let's get this federal government limited. Let's get them focused on establishing free market principles, getting us out of debt, and securing our nation, period, end of story. And, you know, the other things, like, you know, our borders and all the things that they're supposed to be involved in, let's just get them out of the things they're not supposed to be involved in so we can reclaim our respective liberties in our respective states. But you see how that would bring harmony in national elections? You take all of these different groups, and we focus on the very few national things, national important things. We'll be winning elections for the next, 50 years, 100 years, who knows?
Great.
We just got to take the battles back to our states. Yeah.
Yeah. Along the lines of the 10th Amendment, I want to ask your thought on this. We've got a state like Arizona that's trying to protect its borders, and the federal government saying, no, that's our job, you can't interfere. Now, the 10th Amendment tells us that unless the states are prohibited from something, then
right.
That's reserved to them. Now, it is reserved. Immigration and border protection is assigned as a power to the federal government. But there's not. Is there anything in the Constitution that says if the federal government has that power, that the states can't also have that same power?
Well, isn't it interesting? I thought about this, Tom. It's an interesting variable because it's a shared border, isn't it? I mean, it's a federal and a state jurisdiction at the same time, isn't it?
Right.
So it's really weird.
And then,
Well,
we have a circuit court that ruled that by engaging in border security and stopping criminals and then asking their immigration status was interfering with the federal government. I don't know of anything in the Constitution that says about interfering with the federal government. For example, and I used this example before, and I'm going to use it again today, how many federal crimes are there? Federal crimes like kidnapping, robbing banks, and then going across state lines and on, that local and state law enforcement officers go, oh, there goes a bank robber driving right by, or there's a kidnapper, or there's a rapist. You know what? That's federal. I can't interfere. I can't arrest that person. And so what I came up with was, as I look through federal law and the Constitution, that enforcement of federal law from the federal aspect is, yes, one, an FBI agent can catch somebody robbing a bank, but the only thing that the federal government is allowed to do is, when it comes to federal crimes and excludes the states, is the investigation. It's theirs to do. They can ask for help. And the prosecution, this is the key. The federal government gets to prosecute, but apprehension or stopping a federal crime, any law enforcement officer can do that. So I don't know how, if this ruling stands, that local law enforcement officers are interfering with immigration officers by asking immigration status, then I guess local law enforcement officers from now on cannot get involved in the enforcement of any federal crimes. That's the way I would read it.
Well, if we take this from a historical point of view, let's go back to when the FBI was created, right? Again, the states were created way before the FBI, right? So,
correct.
Obviously. So you would think it's the opposite. When the FBI was created, the states must have been like, who the hell are you? Who the hell are you to come within our borders, right? This is our jurisdiction.
Yeah, yeah.
You got a problem, call us, and we'll go apprehend this person. You know what I mean? So when you look at it like that, yes, we can have – why don't we have a partnership? The federal government should be calling Governor Brewer or whoever and saying, we understand X, Y, and Z. Can you apprehend them? It should be like that, right?
Yeah.
There should be a partnership.
Right.
But for the federal government to say to the states, you can't get involved because this is a federal problem, that is just beyond irresponsible, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it is.
Well, you know, this kind of leads into my next question, and that is you've got an audio file posted on Hyperblog Cafe entitled Congress Has Not Unlimited Powers. Can you tell us about that and what you talked about in that?
It's just a post. It's a quote. Let me see. Congress has not unlimited power. I remember it. Let me just read it really quick. Congress.
I mean, you had a Thomas Jefferson quote. There was an audio file there, and I didn't know if maybe you actually discussed that Jefferson quote or not.
Yeah, Congress has not, let's read it. Congress has not unlimited powers to provide for the general welfare, but only those specifically enumerated. That's the one?
Yeah.
Yeah.
He said that on numerous occasions. And I don't know if you wanted to elaborate on that, because I actually used to use the entire quote as a campaign quotation about the government overreaching its authority, especially with something like Obamacare.
Well, it goes back to states' rights again. I don't listen. If a state says we want to have a social safety net, transitional programs for people that are displaced, you know, even a few permanent programs for like absolute disabled people, I mean, that's a state's rights issue. The federal government making these kind of programs is deeply unconstitutional. So I think what Jefferson was saying, that here's the 16 explicit powers enumerated to the federal government. Any monies appropriated for anything outside of the 16 things is null and void.
Yeah. Well, I read the first enumeration is this. If the federal government felt it was necessary to provide health care for people, then it could raise our taxes and purchase it for us, and that's it. That's as far as it can go. It can't create a program. It can't absorb an entire industry. That's unconstitutional. They have no authority to do that.
Right. But, I mean, how can they even raise money if it's not even explicitly a power given to them?
Yeah, exactly. Well, I'm going to do
right,
the quote that
saying,
I used to do on the camp.
I think that's what Jefferson's saying, is that all these powers, like one of those 16 powers is the power to tax, but it has to be applied to an enumerated, right? There has to be an explicit
right.
purpose to which
right.
to tax
yeah.
for. I mean, how
exactly.
arbitrary is that, Tom? If you could tax, as Judge Napolitano says, any event, regulate any activity, that's arbitrary, isn't it? Unlimited.
It's very arbitrary. And in fact, healthcare is not a general welfare. It's specific welfare. So it's really not, you know, and so here's the quote I remember. Jefferson actually talked about this and wrote it in several different ways. And the one that I picked out, he said, they, referring to Congress, are not to do anything they please to provide for the general welfare, but only to raise revenue for that purpose. Giving a distinct and independent power the authority to do whatever would be for the good of the union renders all preceding and subsequent enumerations of power completely useless. It creates, let's see, it's been a long time since I said it, and I'm not reading this. It creates a Congress with the authority to constitute, constitutes a Congress with the authority to do whatever would be for the good of the United States of America. And as they would be the sole judges of good and evil, it will give them the power to do whatever evil they choose. And there was one thing I left out of there. It said that it reduces the whole instrument to that of a single phrase. And then that last phrase I said, constituting a Congress with the authority to do whatever would be for the good of the United States, and as they would be the sole judges of good and evil. And so that's what he was warning against. You can't generalize, and Paula, you've heard me say this, and anybody that's been listening to the show has heard me say it a million times. Even a Federalist like Alexander Hamilton said, if we were meant to generalize these specific enumerations, the ones that you keep talking about, Mark, then it would be absurd to have the specific enumerations if we were meant to generalize.
My God, Alexander Hamilton must be a deeply conflicted man, wasn't he?
Yeah.
Seriously, I mean, like, what you just said is like spot on constitutionally, but he was like the original Obama in some ways, wasn't he? The original nationalist.
Right. Well, you know why? I will tell you, and you got it right, the original Obama. The reason he said that was he said that in the Federalist Papers, in other words, trying to pitch and sell a centralized federal government to the states. Yeah. But once we had it, then he wanted to run wild with it. So he was really an opportunist, I think, in some terms, like
shut up, right? It's the same thing. It's like the idea between what I said on the campaign trail and what I'm going to do once you elect me, right? It's the same concept.
Yeah. That was Alexander Hamilton.
Right. He pushed very hard to get that I think they knew exactly what they were doing, the Federalists. You just, you know, ratify that Constitution and we'll take care of it from there. It's really sad thing. Yeah. Hey, Tom.
Well, we're getting close. We've got about 10 minutes left before I have to bolt out of here. But, Paul, anything else you want to ask of Mark?
I do. I wanted to know what was important for listeners to know right now about their country.
Oh, geez.
I know there's probably a lot of things, but what is one thing that you could think of, I guess?
Well, obviously we all know. I'll tell you, we all know that obviously the debt is just way off the charts, out of control. And
of course.
If there's anything I could say, if I had like 10 seconds to say it, I would say stop once and for all thinking about these godforsaken parties. It doesn't matter if there's an R or a D. Hold them both accountable to the Constitution.
Exactly.
Now, how do you get them to follow it? That's going to take a lot of work. I don't know how we're going to get there. But the point is, don't let them mislead you, because I do truly believe they are a smokescreen.
Their
facade.
Yeah. Well, we called out the Republicans today with their baloney, not continuing resolution, but bill for the remainder of this fiscal year. And I'm deeply disappointed in that. And so I think one of the answers is just keep firing and rehiring and hiring new faces for Congress until they start getting it right. I mean, I'm serious. The way my Congress person is voting, I'm just going to keep hiring somebody new.
There is a great example of this. Dennis Kucinich and Ron Paul, this recent partnership with the Libyan, what I call fiasco, because obviously it wasn't voted on by Congress. The president just unilaterally, you know, advocated our representation to the UN. That being said, though, Dennis Kucinich, who I bet all of us would agree is far to the left with some domestic, you know, economic issues, but when it comes to the Federal Reserve, when it comes to you know, matters of war. He's pretty constitutional, you know? And he's, you know, he got together with Ron Paul to oppose this Libyan thing, and they're getting together with some Federal Reserve issues. I think that really harkens back to our founding days when we didn't have, well, in the beginning there wasn't parties, but, you know, that I call them permanent fashion, that two people or a group of people could work together on a piece of legislation or certain common things, right? You know, you get that legislation passed, that initiative, and, you know, you just go back to the, you go on to the next issue. So the parties, what they do is kind of like a herd mentality, isn't it? That even if you know something's unconstitutional or something's not right, you still have to push to vote for it to keep your party in power.
Yeah.
You see what I'm saying? It's not diligence to the Constitution. It's diligence to a party. That's the problem. It's about getting the party back in power. It's not about upholding our Constitution.
So, exactly. Well, I think a lot of Tea Partiers learn this, and I spoke with quite a few of them after the 2010 November election there.
Mm-hmm.
And I would ask a lot of them that fought really hard to get rid of a liberal incumbent that really wasn't following the Constitution, had no intention of following the Constitution. That's why they wanted to get rid of them so badly. I asked them, did you get the grassroots constitutional candidate elected? And typically the answer was no, because it really boiled down to money, and they thought, well, let's at least get the Republican in there, or the, you know, the independent or whatever, the, who they considered to be the conservative. Let's get them in there, and then we can work from there. And what I'm seeing some groups do now is they're kind of just kind of floating along and going, well, we succeeded and we got the Republican in. On the other hand, I'm seeing some other groups go, now we're going to hold their feet to the fire. We're watching every vote they make, and we're calling them out on votes we don't like. So I don't know how this is going to progress. My hope is that these Tea Party groups aren't going to let up on their newly elected officials but hold their feet to the fire. But I'm seeing some cases where that's not the case.
We got some very good examples. We got Mike Lee from Utah. I happen to really like Mike Lee. Connie Mack, Rand Paul.
Yeah.
I think they're very good examples of, and with the Tea Party behind them, very constitutional. But again, how long is it going to take to get, you know, 50, I mean, get 100, 200, 300 people that think like that? How much time do we have? I don't know.
Yeah. You know, I think the problem is it's the uninformed masses. They're just too many people that don't, but they're learning, they're catching on. I'm glad to see that, but you're right. I don't know how long it's going to take, but boy, the people
that
knew anything about, people that, the average person that knew anything about the Commerce Clause 2 years ago was probably almost, you know, zero, the average American, and now maybe 20% of them understand it at least, and another 20% kind of get.
I was deeply skeptical with the Tea Party in the beginning. I knew a few of the people that were starting it, and I was like, you know, please don't get co-opted by the GOP, please. You know, that was one of my fears. I don't know. You know, in some ways, though, again, when you think about Thomas Jefferson, you think the Republican Party is the natural place, right, for, you know, very small government, you know what I'm saying, right, traditional Republicans.
Right. Right.
Is probably the natural place. But the problem is you still have so many of these establishments, you know, the John Boehners and the Mitch McConnells. And not that they're not good people, but they unfortunately just don't understand or really care enough about our Constitution to, you know, properly represent it, you know.
Right. It's a game. It's all a game. Now, I'll just tell a quick story. I had a friend of mine that was running for Congress. And he got the chance to meet John Boehner, and he had run once before, and he had some more name recognition. He was able to raise more money, but still, the first thing when he came up to John Boehner and got to have a chance to chat with him for a few minutes, the first thing Boehner asked him was, how much money have you raised? It was the first thing. That's all he cared about. How much money have you raised? And he said, well, we're doing the best we can, and he told him, and it wasn't much, and Boehner was like, well, it's not worth me talking to you if you can't raise more than that. Like he didn't really care. I do know that you've got to be able to raise money, and it's a sad thing because you've got to reach the uninformed masses. But for a politician that's supposed to be, you know, now he was a leader at the time, and now he's definitely the leader of the party. We need something better than that. We need some people that are a little bit. We're pretty much out of time, Mark. I want to let everybody know one more time where they can reach you. You can go to hyperblogcafe.com. You can go look on Twitter. I recommend everybody follow you on MarkRoss67, and then Facebook, same thing, MarkRoss67. Any last words you have for the folks tonight?
Well, I had one last thought, and you know, maybe you can think about it. Maybe next time we talk, we can get more into it. But I registered as an independent 3 years ago, and that's something that I've been pushing a lot, that if we became a nation of predominantly independents, again, it would be very kind of hearkening back to the beginning, and that would be a very good check, too, on both of these parties, because now we're a nation of independents and understanding the Constitution. So,
right.
Well,
we'll talk about that, because some states where, like Florida, where as an independent you can't vote in the primary for whoever
here
you
in
want.
New Jersey.
You can,
right.
Then you,
but,
like in my race, there was no independent in the race, so independents didn't get to race in the primary, and I would have probably gotten a lot more votes. But so there, we need to get around that. We need to change the laws.
I'm saying that's their
primary,
way to keep us. That's their way to keep us. That's the way to keep themselves in power, I should say, isn't it?
Yeah, it is.
If you think of
it
the
is.
Republican and Democrat parties as unions, consider them like unions, right? And they know how to have a monopoly on our government. That's what it is, the monopoly.
Yeah. Well, we can change that at the state level because it's a state law, and if we work to change
that's
that, then I agree with you. So we'll have to talk about that some more. We'll have you back on the show. It's great having you, Mark. Pleasure.
Thanks, Tom.
Paula, any last words from you?
No, I think we're pretty much all set. It was good talking to you, Mark. Thanks for the insight.
I appreciate you having me on.
Yeah.
Thank you so much.
Oh, you're welcome.
All right.
Okay, have a great day.
Will you take care, Paul? You take care, Mark. I'm thinking about, I'm looking at the door getting ready to dash for it. But, you take care. We'll talk to you again soon. And, Paula, it was great having you on here. We'll be on again tomorrow. I don't remember off the top of my head what we're specifically talking about tomorrow. Oh, yeah, it's tax day, so we're going to be talking about taxes and things like that. And then for everybody out there, we'll be on a regular time tomorrow, 4 p.m. to 5 p.m. Eastern, usaradionetwork.com. And you can follow us on the American Hour Radio Show on Facebook and the American Hour on Twitter. And, again, your Twitter account, Paula? Oh, Paula's gone. Oops, nope, I somehow, believe me, I didn't want to hit your microphone, Paula, but somehow I did, and I'm trying to bring you back. We got there. Sorry about that.
Okay.
No, that's what I'm trying to rush here at the last second. But, yeah, your Twitter account for everybody again?
It's at Megawatt Queen.
Megawatt Queen. All right, awesome. Well, I got 2 minutes to throw my my uniform on and bolt out of this door. Great talking with you again today, Paula. We'll talk again tomorrow, 4 p.m. on the American Hour. And everybody, thanks for listening in. Take care.
Have a great flight.
Thanks. I appreciate it.
Bye.
You're listening to the American Hour with Commander Tom Garcia on the USA Talk Radio Network.